This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
News, weather, traffic, money, politics, big interviews, and bold opinions. It's what's happening right now. This is Mornings with Simi.
How do you feel about uncertainty? It's a feeling I think that most people are a little uncomfortable with. I mean, think about that for a second. We as humans, for the most part, we like easy answers, even to complex questions. I mean, it explains so much about what's wrong with politics too, isn't it? Because the truth is, there are no easy answers to hard or complicated questions. So why are we so uncomfortable with that reality? And is it possible to ever truly know something for certain? I love a topic like this. So let's talk about it with Kevin McCain, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Why are we so uncertain about uncertainty?
Well, that's a great question. I think part of it is, one, as you just mentioned, we don't like it, right? So it's very uncomfortable to be uncertain. And I think part of it is it's easy to ignore uncertainty in some cases, right? So if I'm right now, I think that I'm talking to you rather than, you know, an AI chatbot or something. But there's a slight chance that I could be wrong, but that chance is so minute that really I can just ignore it, even though I am, to some extent, a little bit uncertain. And I think, you know, it gets easy for us to ignore bigger uncertainties because they make us uncomfortable. So if I'm trying to decide, you know, whether I should take a new job or whether I should move, those sorts of uncertainties are really amplified in our lives, and it's harder to ignore. But I think in any case, it's exactly what you mentioned. They make us uncomfortable, and so we just want to ignore them.
And is that also why, like, if we believe something, we're going to believe in it, and it's very hard to change our mind, is because it's about the certainty. We want that certainty.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, we want the comfort. It's very comforting to know or to think we know something is, you know, 100%. Then I don't have to worry about it anymore. So if I think, well, you know, this is obviously, once I've made my mind up, but if I believe, oh, I'm certain this is the best decision, that kind of takes the pressure off of me. If I make my mind up and I go, well, you know, I'm 90% sure that this is the best decision, there's that little bit of nagging doubt. And it's, like you said, if I can commit myself 100%, that makes it much easier for me in terms of my own psychological comfort. But on the downside, it makes it a lot harder for me to change my mind because I'm already fully committed.
Right. Have we always been like this, do you think? Is this just human nature?
I think it is just human nature. I think, you know, uncertainty can be very scary. You know, we want to know what's going to happen. We want to predict and, you know, make it in our environment. And part of that is by making decisions that are well informed about what is likely to happen. And so it's always been a concern of how do we navigate the uncertainty. And I think that one of the things that is comforting for us is to treat things as much more certain than they are.
So we make things certain because that's how we want them.
Right. We make them, at least in our own thinking, we treat them as certain because that's how we want them to be. You know, they're never actually certain, but we treat them that way. And I think some of it too, you know, is how we're taught. We're presented certain things. We're presented things, say, in our science class or whatever. We're often taught without the uncertainty being made clear and, you know, apparent to us. And so we think, well, I learned this in science class, therefore it's certain. Rather than, you know, if you talk to scientists, they'll say, well, no, it's not certain. It's, you know, what is the percent probable? Yeah.
But we don't like that. Kevin, we want science to be the thing that is certain, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. We even have this, we run into this error where a lot of people, if you tell them, well, you know, scientists are, you know, think that this is about 95% likely, they'll go, well, then that's not real science. So we even run into the error of people think, if it's not certain, it can't be real science, which is, of course, absolutely false.
I guess it explains a lot, though, considering, as you put it, the world is a confusing, complicated place, and we're just looking for things that help us navigate it, I guess.
Right, yeah. And one of the things, like with anything else, you know, if we can simplify things, that can be helpful to us. And one way we can simplify, you know, in our reasoning, in our navigating our environment, is by treating things as if they're certain, even though they're not, because it's easier to reason if we're treating things as 100% likely than if we're actually treating things more probabilistically, where they're, you know, 90% or 75% likely. Probabilistic reasoning is just, in a lot of ways, harder for us than non-probabilistic reasoning.
So is this something that we need to kind of wrap our head around? We need to understand that science isn't also going to be 100%. Nothing really in life is 100%.
Right. I think that's exactly right. You know, there's a famous saying that, you know, only. I don't know. Even taxes aren't certain, because some people can cheat their way out of them sometimes. So, yeah, things in life are just not going to be certain. And so the best thing we can really do is learn how to evaluate evidence and work with and manage uncertainties.
This goes a long ways, I think, also, Kevin, to dealing with some of the things that we see, like in social media today, with people arguing about, you know, this is real. No, you have to believe this. It's just people looking for more certainty in uncertain times, I feel like, which is why they become so strident about it.
I think that's exactly right. I tend to think that you hit the nail on the head there, that people want something really solid to kind of rest on or to build on. And so they're often grasping at things and, unfortunately, latch onto things that are really uncertain and treat them as solid, whereas, you know, they'd be better off reaching for things that are at least more close, you know, closer to certain, and treating them as they should be. I think we all tend to run into the error of treating things as certain when they're not, but we can also make that mistake of just, once we realize things are uncertain, treating everything as if it's on a par. You know, so we acknowledge that something in science is uncertain, and then people will say, well, then so my pet conspiracy theory that's also uncertain, well, it's just equally good because it's all uncertain. And I think that's, you know, a deep mistake that leads to a lot of problems.
Okay, then how do we deal with that then? Do you go by the probability of it? Like, yeah, but mine is like 90% certain.
Yeah, I think one of the things we do is we have to do the hard work of looking at the evidence and seeing, okay, yeah, they're both uncertain, but the odds of, you know, the conspiracy theory, whatever it happens to be, being true are like, you know, 1% or less. The odds of this particular scientific theory being true are, you know, 95% likely. If you're going to bet, that's the way you should bet. And I think what we need to do to get better at this is learn to look at the evidence and compare what's best supported by the evidence and make our decisions that way, rather than assuming that something has to be certain or it's kind of a free-for-all.
Right. That's a good way to look at it. I'm going to practice that. Kevin, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
That was so fascinating. That's Kevin McCain, a professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama, talking about the issue of certainty. It's pretty much what we're all looking for, especially when it comes to, you know, political debates or arguing about anything really on social media, is that people want to convince you that they are the ones who are 100% right. So why do we always need uncertainty? Or need certainty? Because really the world is, you know, filled with things that are maybe 60, 70% right, not necessarily 100%. If you want to weigh in, send me at cknw.com.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Today is the day to change your password, and Scott Schantz is here to tell us why. I don't want to change my password.
That is why, Simi, you're going to get hacked because you don't want to change your password. And that's exactly why we're having this conversation. Today, Simi, is World Password Day. And people know that we have this, but it's not an actual, like, numerical day. World Password Day is the first Thursday of May. So that's today, May 2nd, the first Thursday of May is when it falls. And it's a day when the online community takes a moment to just sort of say, hey, guys, you should change your password. You probably haven't in a year. And today's the day that you should do it because, you know, the systems that the hackers are using to try to get your info and get your stuff, they're getting more complicated every single day. And the things that remain the same, Simi, are the sucky passwords that everybody uses.
Okay. I have a system for my passwords, but let's talk about the ones, I'm sorry, how did you put it?
The sucky passwords that everyone uses.
Okay, let's talk about those.
And I want to talk about your system after because I'll explain something to you. But first, this should come as no surprise to anyone. The most common passwords, same as they were last year, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
No, who still does this?
Apparently a lot of people. Password, all lowercase.
No.
Admin, all lowercase. And unknown, all lowercase. So those are the most common passwords. And it's not even just that hackers are typing those things in. They have computer systems that just try all these different things, right? Like they can write a script that just tries all of these various passwords to get into your computer. Now, Simi, you say you have a system.
Yeah, I'm not telling you what my system is, Scott.
Okay, but let me ask you this. How can you tell me how many characters it is?
Oh, it depends. That's my system.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know. Because obviously, the more, here's what you need to know. The more characters you have, the more complex it is. This information I'm taking from an online company called Hive that does online security.
You know when you're prompted to change a password and then it judges you on your password? Like it'll say weak or medium or strong. Now, some people might just type it in and they don't care if it says weak. I view that as a challenge. Ah. So I won't quit until I find one that says strong.
Okay. Now, do you use the same password for all of your different accounts? You use different passwords. How do you keep track of them?
I have a system, I told you.
Okay, and you don't need to share your system with us, but I found this interesting. So that I found this spreadsheet that basically breaks out how long it will take a sophisticated computer algorithm to crack a system.
Okay.
So the easiest, most crackable things are if you have six or less characters, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and you only use numbers in your password, any combination of six numbers, it can be cracked instantly. Like it takes a sophisticated computer no time to crack your password. If you start to add a lowercase letter, it goes up to 2 minutes. Your password can be cracked in 2 minutes. If you add an upper and a lowercase letter, that goes up to 2 hours. And then if you add a symbol, it goes up to 12 hours. So that's with six characters.
And that also, when you get to that point, you're no longer worth it.
I guess, yeah, at 12 hours. But maybe if you're somebody specific. But Simi, watch how this develops, okay? So if we go from six characters up to 9 characters, okay? If you just have numbers, 6 minutes. If you add a lowercase letter, 3 weeks. Upper and lowercase letters and numbers with 9 digits, 33 years. It would take a sophisticated computer 33 years to crack your password. Then you start adding in a symbol, like everybody just does, the engineering department team here, they say shift one. Everybody just adds the exclamation mark to the end of their password.
That's funny. Yeah,
that takes it to 479 years.
So clearly it
works. To crack your password. Yeah. And if you really want to be very, very specific, this chart that I found lists the number of characters. It goes up to 18, but I'll be honest. My system that I have something similar to you. I'm 9 characters, uppercase, lowercase, numbers, and letters. So I'm at that 479 years to crack my password. If you go up to 18 characters, numbers, letters, uppercase, lowercase, and a symbol, it will take 19 quintillion years.
Wow. I was just counting my
password
in my system. So I run between 12 and 18 characters.
Okay, so let's err on the side of caution here. Let's say you have 12 characters, and I'm going to assume that you use uppercase, lowercase, and
a
symbol.
It's a combination of all of these things.
Okay,
yes.
So if you do that, it would take 164 million years to crack your password.
Okay.
So in just a couple of minutes here, we've gone from instantly, a computer can crack it instantly if you just do like a birthday or a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, an anniversary, any of those number things. If you add uppercase, lowercase, and symbol, takes it up to 164 million years. So it's worth it to just put those, you know, put those things, you know, there's lots of talk about hacks in the news.
No kidding.
It's worth it to update your password. And today is the day to do it.
World Password Day. All right. We've all got some work to do. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
That is Scott Shuntz. If you want to weigh in, please, please don't be using 123456 as your password. Not today. Not after what we just learned there. You can email me, Simi@cknw.com.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Time for us to check in with Vaughn Palmer from the Vancouver Sun this morning. Good morning, Vaughn.
And good morning, Simi.
All right, let's get an update on this whole decriminalization walk-back situation. Where are we at with this? Because they make an announcement, but there still have to be a lot of things that happen before we do this.
Oh, yeah. The walking backward began last Friday afternoon, so we're coming up on the first one-week anniversary, and it is still a struggle to find out exactly what's going on or even what they're calling it, because they've said, no, we're not recriminalizing, and yet they've also said we're recriminalizing. So what happened yesterday is the government finally released the letter that they wrote to the federal government asking for Ottawa's help in severely restricting open drug use in BC. So this entails a change in federal legislation. It can be done with a stroke of a pen. It doesn't mean they have to put a vote in Parliament. Just be done through regulation. So what the letter says is, we would very much like you to restrict open drug use in British Columbia to a very small number of places. It was pretty wide open before. So those places where you'll still be able to take illicit drugs, possess illicit drugs, the small quantities, private residences. For people who don't have private residences, if you're legally sheltering, so that'd be in a shelter, it could be in an SRO hotel, and it, I think, I'm not sure about that one, they don't specifically say, and a tent in camp. Then we get to clinics. So a clinic that provides overdose services or recovery services, you'd be able to do it there. Everywhere else, no more. So no public spaces, and that, Simi, includes public spaces where the public is welcome, whether it's implied that they're welcome, whether or not they have to pay a fee to get in there. It includes transit. It would appear to me to include bus stops and SkyTrain stations, which have been one of the big problems. So they're very, very much narrowing where you can do drugs, possess and consume, inhale, because a lot of it's inhalation now. It's still not clear from reading all this exactly how it will work in some of the most difficult places to enforce this law. It'd be straightforward: parks, playgrounds, bus stops, SkyTrain stations. But the big problem is still with the hospitals. And I must admit, Simi, I've been listening carefully to what the government's saying about how this is going to work. And I have to say, they don't know how it's going to work. And I'm hearing that from the healthcare system too. Everybody wants to make this work. They are trying to adapt, the hospitals in particular, the health regions, but it's still an open question. I know the government's hoping this will go away, but I don't think it's going to go away. Oh, and yes, what about Ottawa? So they've written them a letter. Federal government said, well, at one point they said, well, we haven't even heard a request yet from the province. Well, now they have. And Simi, the federal government is saying, well, we're looking at it and we're studying it, but you know, Ottawa doesn't exactly say how high when a province says jump, especially if it's not Ontario and Quebec. So I don't know when we're going to get this from Ottawa, when they're going to change the regulations, exactly how they're going to change the regulations. And then, of course, the police and the authorities out here are waiting for instructions on what's actually changed, because they really want to deal with this, but they still don't know precisely how it's going to unfold.
Right. So what are their options then, if Ottawa is slow?
An interesting option today in the National Post, Chris Selly, he points out that, You know, the letter to Ottawa from the province says we have to do this because the courts out here have been blocking the provincial attempt to deal with this. The courts sided with the rights of drug takers and issued a temporary injunction against the provincial attempt to do this by law. Well, it's been pointed out by others, province has the option under the Canadian Constitution to invoke the notwithstanding clause, which essentially says, in spite of what the courts say, we're doing this. It's used all the time about Quebec. Nobody makes a big deal of it. Saskatchewan used it recently in this battle over the use of pronouns in the school system, and they invoked it. So the BC government could, if they thought this was a sufficiently serious threat to public safety in British Columbia, which I think it is, and to their re-election chances, which I think it is, they could invoke the notwithstanding clause. Now, ideologically, New Democrats are totally opposed to that. They say you're not going to trample people's rights, even though the clause was put there in the Canadian Constitution to be used in situations just like this one. I don't think they'll do it. They are entirely dependent on Ottawa riding to their rescue. And Simi, you know, I don't cover the federal government on a daily basis, but I think from my reading of the coverage nationally, Ottawa is somewhat distracted by other issues.
Yes.
So I don't know whether they're going to get around to doing this. David Eby said he talked to the prime minister and he was kind of vague about what he actually asked the prime for, because that letter hadn't been written at that point. But he said, talk to the prime minister. The prime minister understands the urgency of the situation here in British Columbia, and the premier believes that Ottawa will act quickly. Well, it's a week tomorrow. We'll see.
We will see about that. Also, did they say they could think about invoking the notwithstanding clause, or that's just an option that is, you know, out there?
It's an option out there. I think the Conservatives, of course, have already suggested it. They're on the ball on this one, and they're comfortable with the idea. BC United, I don't think, has asked for it. It hasn't been asked directly in the legislature yet. There is a question period in the House today, so maybe it'll come up. But as I said, the John Horgan, back when Doug Ford was talking about using the clause against, I think, a labor dispute in Ontario, John Horgan made a point of saying NDP would never, ever, ever use that clause in the Constitution. So it would mean walking back that commitment to do it. I don't think the New Democrats are looking at that as an option. But, you know, right now, they're waiting on Ottawa. They're waiting for Ottawa to give them what they want. It hasn't happened yet. Premier says he's sure they'll do it. Well, we'll see.
All right, we are back with Vaughn Palmer this morning, and we're talking about an investigation, finally, into what happened with Litton. And Vaughn, this has been a long time coming.
This is incredible. So, I mean, it's been 3 years, June 30th.
Already.
Litton burned to the ground in a matter of minutes. And, you know, the politicians went there. We'll be there for you. You know, don't worry. We're going to rebuild Litton. John Horgan said it's going to be a state-of-the-art, world-class community. We're going to do this. Well, you know, it's still, what is it now? There's 3 years. There's been a little bit of work done there, but there's been huge holdups, any number of reasons. And the government has done everything it can to make sure there's no independent scrutiny of what happened there. The Public Accounts Committee of the legislature, the opposition made a motion last fall to have, you know, request a look into this, and the New Democrats, of course, used their majority to vote it down. They've ducked question after question in the legislature, but finally, the Independent Auditor General, an agency that the New Democrats can't control, no matter how much they might try, has a great statement on his website posted yesterday. Michael Pickup, he's going to look into what happened with Litton, the provincial government's accountability, the provincial government's response, why it's taken so long. And finally, we're going to get an independent review of all this.
I can't even believe it's taken this long. Yeah. And some people have been very good about kind of making sure this stays in the limelight kind of thing.
Yeah. Full credit here to Jackie Teagard. She's the BC United MLA for, well, her riding includes Lytton. And she has been on this. I don't know how many times she's made a statement in the House. She's the one who tried to get the Public Accounts Committee of the legislature to launch into this. And she and Peter Milibar, another BC United member, the one for Kamloops, wrote a letter to the Auditor General, okay, a year ago, saying, will you look into this? You've got the power to do it. And pick up his response. So it's taken a while, but again, I'm not going to dump on him. He's doing it. He's got a lot of other priorities and a lot of other issues. He's doing it. He's launched into it. He is going to examine, he says, the province's role and responsibilities for disaster recovery, its support for Lytton, including how much funding it actually contributed, and the challenges that were faced in rebuilding Lytton and why the province could do maybe a better job on that. So he's doing it. His report won't come out until next year. It takes a while to look in these things. And as you might imagine, the government will not be springing into action to help him and give him everything he wants. I'm sure they're going to be dragging their feet. But we're finally going to get it. And it's long overdue. Full credit to especially Jackie Teagard for pushing this, mm-hmm. trying to keep it alive. There's been some good news media coverage too. You know, Fraser Valley newspaper and my colleague Glenda Loomis from the Vancouver Sun. There's been lots of coverage trying to keep the story alive. But what a struggle! And Simi, when you look at it, you know, a town burns to the ground, and 3 years later, there's not much been done. You know, Fort McMurray in Alberta was rebuilt in the amount of time it's taken our government to duck questions about why they haven't done it.
That's very true. Well, it sounds to me like the Auditor General is working on quite a few significant reports these days, but we'll wait for that. But also, we have to mention the Surrey policing situation here. I know we have to because of this court case that's going on.
So it turns out there's a 45-minute phone conversation between Mike Farnworth and Brenda Locke taken in the middle of all this standoff that, you know, this kind of reveals two people that are talking past each other. I guess that's the most generous thing I could say, trying to sort things out and swearing up and down that they really want to work this out. But you listen to it and you go, you know, these two don't really like each other and they don't communicate very well. The challenge for the provincial government when you go through it, and I'm relying on Rob Shaw's account of this because I have not listened to the tape myself, but the challenge that you get through this is, you know, if you've got a problem being handled by two people that are talking past each other and don't particularly trust each other, and Locke comes out afterward and says that Farnworth is bullying her, well, she's the mayor of Surrey. She's not going anywhere. The premier could appoint somebody else to deal with Surrey on this issue. He's not done that. If he really wanted to make progress on this issue, he should have done that some time ago.
Doesn't look like that's going to happen, though, does it? And no, also, I read Rob's coverage on this, too, and it wasn't just necessarily the two top people here. At the lower level, some of the bureaucrats didn't like each other either.
No, and, you know, the problem the bureaucrats had here was the provincial government was pushing its public servants and appointees to get it done. The premier said at one point he was getting beaten up by the opposition on the public safety issue in Surrey, and elections coming, they wanted it done. So there's huge pressure on the provincial public servants. And Surrey's public service, the mayor and a majority of the councillors wanted to go back to the RCMP. They thought it was going to be very, very expensive to go ahead with Surrey Policing Services. And they were telling their public servants, like, we want a clear answer on how much this is going to cost. And we want the provincial government to pick up the tab because they're imposing it on us. So it wasn't a lack of professionalism on the part of the public servants. It was the fact that they had their masters, provincial government and the city government, had a completely different agenda here. And as a public servant, you're caught in the middle. You got to do, mm-hmm. you know, you shouldn't be making political decisions on your own. You're trying to do what you're being asked to do. The other side isn't listening because the other side said, we don't trust you and we're not persuaded that this is the right way to go.
Talk about broken. All right, Vaughn, thank you.
Bye-bye, Cindy.
That is Vaughn Palmer there from the Vancouver Sun.
This is Mornings with Simi.
For a very long time, it has felt like if you wanted to get ahead around here, you had to get into real estate. It's been it's a spinoff industry that everybody was investing in, no matter what their day jobs were. Well, could that be changing? Our Scott Shantz has been looking into that this morning and joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Yeah, it seems like that, doesn't it? That everybody has just been scrambling. The only way to generate wealth is through real estate. You know, we hear it's just been the way that it's been, right, for like 10 years. Well, Bethany Lindsay, she's a reporter with the Investigative Journalism Foundation, and she shared a story with me about an investigation that she is doing about how this is not necessarily the case, and unfortunately, people are starting to get, I don't want to say duped, but maybe taken advantage of. It has to do with some online spreading and marketing. And I started just by asking her, tell me about this investigative journalism piece that you are working on.
Okay, yeah. So this was actually something that my editors noticed on Facebook. He kept getting all these ads to invest in real estate development companies. In particular, there was one BC company called the Sintera Group that was advertising 15% annual returns if you invest in their real estate development projects. And my editor said, how can you advertise that high of a return? Is this legit? Are they breaking any rules? Can you look into it? So I started looking into it. And basically what I found was a whole bunch of companies across Canada doing real estate development, taking advantage of a piece of legislation that was made to help startups raise money, but now it's being used mainly by real estate companies promising these big returns to unsophisticated investors who are probably not going to read the fine print and find out that those 15% returns aren't really guaranteed.
Yeah, and I feel like it's almost like low-hanging fruit, because who is not intrigued by the housing market, right? Especially here in BC. Like, if anything is going to get you 15% return, it's got to be housing, right? Because we've all sort of heard these stories about how people have generated so much wealth there, and we hear those stories and people want a piece of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the experts I talked to said, you know, so many of us are completely shut out of the housing market. Like, I know I am. You can't afford to buy a house. You can't afford to make those huge gains that people, you know, who got into the housing market much earlier have been able to see. And so this is kind of an opportunity to get some of those returns. But the issue is, you know, over the past few years, because of the pandemic, because of changing interest rates, you know, it's not as guaranteed as you would think it is. And so this company that I was looking into, the Sintera Group, you know, they've got all these projects in the Kelowna area, in Langford on the island, and for various reasons, they've been just hugely delayed. And so people who got in 3 years ago, 5 years ago, haven't seen any of the returns that they thought they were going to see within, you know, a year or so. And most of these projects haven't even broken ground yet.
So what happens then to somebody who has like invested their money and hasn't seen the return? Is it just strictly a case of like, I have to wait this out? Or is there any like recourse? Is there any chance of people getting their money back out of this? What happens now?
So, you know, I talked to a guy who did put about $53,000 into a project in Kelowna. And, you know, he's turned to the small claims court to try to get that money back. But, you know, really, it's yet to be seen whether he'll see any of that, right? Because, you know, the people who are investing do sign these lengthy agreements that lay out, you know, this is really risky. There's actually a form you have to sign that says right across the top, warning, this is a risky investment. You could lose everything. So, you know, it depends on whether there's actually anything misleading in the documentation, whether, you know, these companies have broken any rules, and that part's yet to be decided. So there's a couple of lawsuits going on right now. I've also learned that it looks like the BC Securities Commission is investigating. We don't know what's going to come out of that. That's all yet to be decided. I did talk to the CEO of this company, and he said, yes, we have a lot of really, really angry investors who are unhappy that they haven't gotten their money back. And he says he's trying to figure out a way to repay them, but that hasn't happened yet either. So they're kind of, you know, at the moment, out of luck.
This idea of, you know, buying into a pre-construction development, you know, a condo, is not inherently a scam, but it feels like that has been taken advantage of here. How do you differentiate between the two? Like, at what point does this become a scam or just a project that's delayed?
Well, you know, I'm not calling this a scam at all, you know, but I think that, you know, the advice that I'm hearing from the legal experts, and, you know, I did have one law professor at UBC read through these agreements, and he said, you know, everything seems above board. I wouldn't call this a scam. I would call this a bad investment. So it's really, you know, if you are presented with an investment that sounds too good to be true, that's saying, you know, we are giving you these huge returns every year, that's a red flag. Anytime you see any guarantee of investment, you know, I've heard that from every security expert I've talked to. You really want to do your due diligence, read through every page of all these disclosures to see what they're actually saying. When they say 15% returns, what does that actually mean? And if you don't understand it, maybe walk away.
That's Bethany Lindsay. She is a reporter with the Investigative Journalism Foundation. And Simi, there is no such thing as easy money, even in Vancouver real estate.
We can say that over and over again, Scott, but I think the temptation is just so great for people. And they see other people making tons of money and they think, well, why can't I do that?
Well, the other thing to remember is all of those people probably have $1 million mortgage.
That's true, too. That is true. Scott, thank you for that.
Yeah,
it is complicated. All right, that is our Scott Shots. If you want to weigh in, Simi at cknw.com.
This is Mornings with Simi.
It is time for our 980 CKNW Taste of the Sea contest. This is courtesy of Sea Lovers, the best fish and chips in town. Caller 6 is going to instantly win $50 to enjoy at Sea Lovers, and we're going to put them in for the grand prize draw of a $5,000 trip courtesy of Sea Lovers, too. We're qualifying winners every show until May the 10th, so keep listening. Now, we have a winner this morning, and the winner is... It is Pat. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning.
Guess what?
I'm so excited.
Yeah, you're caller 6. You just won $50 to Sea Lovers. You going to enjoy yourself?
Oh, fantastically so.
Okay, good. And we're going to put your name in for the grand prize draw. So, Pat, tell me, if you win this $5,000 trip, where are you going?
Venice.
Look at you. You knew right away. You've been planning this.
You bet.
Okay, trip of a lifetime, Pat. Well, fingers crossed for you, okay?
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and hold on the line so we can get all your information so we can get you in for that grand prize draw. Don't forget, we're qualifying winners every day, so keep listening to 980 CKNW for our Taste of the Sea contest and your chance to win. All right, now, did you know that you might be entitled to some money from Facebook? I know that almost sounds like an ad, right? When you put it that way, it sounds too good to be true. But there is actually a Facebook class action lawsuit that was settled and impacts users in BC and 3 other provinces. But what do you need to know here? And importantly, why is Facebook settling all this? What does it say about your privacy and Facebook? Well, joining us now is Amy Morrison, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Language and Literature at the University of Waterloo. Amy, thank you for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Do people, do you think, not understand that, hey, maybe they might be entitled to something here?
Oh, probably. This sounds exactly like the kind of thing that we tell people not to click on
yes.
the internet, right?
Yes.
Sounds like one of those scams like, you know, Gerber baby owes you money, or, you know, click here to denounce Instagram's new privacy policy or whatever it is. But this is a legitimate legal settlement and people are entitled to probably $35.
Okay, $35, nothing to sneeze at, right? They could certainly
it
use that money.
Not, yeah.
Yeah.
You get one cup of coffee at Starbucks for that, I think.
We are headed that way. Amy, why though? Why would Facebook settle this? What was happening?
Well, what was happening was that, as you know, Facebook works on networks of people, right? So you have friends on Facebook, you have mutuals. When something appears in your feed, it has been shared by someone you follow or someone you know. And the idea, this is how influencers work as well, is that we are more likely to purchase products that are recommended to us by people who we know and trust, right? This is a social recommendation engine. And what this lawsuit was about was that Facebook was using people's avatars, like their image associated with their account and their account name, and posting stories in that person's newsfeed that were in fact advertisements that were being fed to people who followed. So like, let's say that you and I are friends on Facebook and you would see something appear in your newsfeed that appeared to be from me and it would be advertising a product. And you would think like, oh, Amy likes this product. She's sharing this. But in fact, I hadn't posted it. Facebook had posted it through my account as a sort of native advertisement. And so this breached people's privacy. It was a use of their likeness.
Yeah,
and
no
their
kidding.
To imply endorsement. Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds egregious. It is gross because that sounds like an egregious thing to do. And people thinking, wait, I'm only getting $35 for this. I guess it's something that Facebook even admitted that they were doing something wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So like the settlement, right, this is why these things tend to get settled and not go to court, is if the full details came out and there was a finding of liability, of course, then that would be an admission of wrongdoing. And so this settlement doesn't necessarily entail that. It's called a sort of compromise, right? A sort of misunderstanding, right? Like, is a good faith gesture. We will do this. But Facebook has been caught up in precisely this type of activity before and have paid out billions of dollars at this point in settlements on various kinds of breaches of user privacy, because its whole value comes from these social networks that are built up and the ties between people and brands online.
So even that money that they're shelling out for this is like a drop in the bucket compared to what they've been making by doing things like this.
Sure. And when the Cambridge Analytica scandal came out, right, where people's user data was being harvested and used for purposes that were not fully disclosed, there was a $1 billion fine that was paid to the U.S. government from that and a $750 million settlement to users about that. So this settlement is much smaller than that settlement, but it is part of a pattern of Facebook being sued for precisely this type of thing.
Amy, what do you think we need to keep in mind here? Like, why are we so, like, we still use this platform when we know they're doing things like this? Like, what do we need to remember and keep in mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, these platforms have become part of the infrastructure of our social lives. They are the third spaces. They're not our homes. They're not our workplaces. They're voluntary social spaces that we go to, like we, you know, used to go to bowling leagues or into cafes when they still had seating and weren't just grab and go, right? So a lot of our social lives take place in these online spaces that are sort of like shopping malls, right? In that they are there actually to make money. They're not really public squares free to use, that somebody is paying to keep the lights on in those places and they will get their profit out of it. And that profit in social networks is to be made by exploiting the social ties between users to sell them products or to harvest data about those users to sell to advertisers or others for whom demographic information of that sort is valuable. So we are the product in these social sites.
That's exactly what I was thinking while you were describing that. Amy, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No, you're very welcome.
That's Amy Morrison, an assistant professor in the Department of Language and Literature at the University of Waterloo, reminding us We are the product. If you think you might be eligible for some of this Facebook money, you have to submit a claim. Actually, you have until August the 20th to do that. Just check it out at, I think, Facebook Settlement. You can Google that for BC and you'll find the info there.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Why is the news filled with all these stories about the Loblaws boycott? I feel like it's everywhere. Social media has been filled with people criticizing the grocery chain for its prices, and yet the stock price is steady, revenue remains strong, but it's become a study for corporations and how they deal with the public. Business schools are talking about this, the Loblaw phenomenon. We're not just talking in Canada either. It is being watched across North America. So what is this company doing wrong? Well, Grant Packard is the program director at the Schulich School of Business at York University and joins us now. Grant, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Is what is happening with Loblaws right now becoming a case study for businesses?
It is to a certain degree. I mean, a successful brand traditionally is one that everybody knows. And ideally, of course, it's one that everybody loves. And the challenge here, when you represent a category, we call it the category prototype, like Loblaws is for Canadian grocery. There's some risk in that, because if people's perceptions of the category change, a lot of the responsibility for that change goes to the prototype, the leading brand. And that can happen in good times, and that can happen in bad times. And clearly, we're in bad times here.
Right. So you've got this people doing a boycott. They're talking about all over social media, and the company hasn't really responded, have they?
No, they haven't. And some would say it probably is risky to do so, because just about anything that the brand says right now could be seen or perceived as trying to deflect responsibility. So there's a lot of risk with talking out when you're in this kind of situation. And some brand or public relations consultants might say, you know what, the better thing to do is just try to ride this out and be quiet. Because when I've seen that, even a couple recent statements, I believe that the president said have been kind of adopted by the kind of consumer movement to say, kind of turned against them, so to speak.
Right. So is that what they actually teach at business school, that maybe it's best to ride these things out and keep quiet?
I mean, every situation is a little bit different, but those are the kind of conversations that the leadership in communications and kind of for the brand are having. You know, what can we do to kind of, increase consumer trust at this time when we know there's a trust problem? And sometimes that means going out and doing something to show, that you can be trusted again. But that the credibility of that kind of behavior, right? It's like greenwashing. Consumers will say, well, you're just doing that for your image. You don't really mean it. And so what a brand has to do, what an organization has to do is say, we need to do things only if they're going to be perceived, hopefully positively, and only if we're doing them genuinely. And so that's the conversation that's happening right now.
Right. I wonder then, do big companies like this, and this is a huge company, do they underestimate what happens on social media, or are we overestimating what happens on social media?
I personally lean towards the latter, and I think there's a lot of evidence of the latter. Social media has democratized information. Everybody has a megaphone of some kind, and things that are, we call them high arousal. So they're emotionally kind of stimulating, and the things that make us angry or things that make us really excited and happy, those things get attention. And everybody feels, the pricing change at grocery. Certainly lower income households feel it a lot worse than higher income households, but social media just can create these dynamics that are really different than what we've seen kind of historically and how media might kind of generate stories. This is, like you say, it's really an example of social media generating a lot of attention about a real problem, but how it's been focused on one brand is probably a social media problem.
Right. But companies, they also need to learn to be nimble, right? Because this could become more than that. I'm sure they're closely watching it, and they have to know how to respond.
Yeah, true. Very true. And I think what Loblaws knows a lot of the actual consumer experience with pricing is very localized. There are some markets, you know, in small towns where Loblaw is the only grocery store, where pricing lands very differently and the problem lands very differently than if you live in a big city and you might have three or four or five different options in your neighborhood. Some of, you know, two of those might be Loblaws, might be a No Frills and a Loblaws brand. And you can realize that, hey, I can get things very inexpensively if I shop at No Frills, but maybe I can't at my Loblaws. So I think for an organization like Loblaws, it's probably going to turn into a local strategy to say, okay, we need to help consumers hopefully realize that we price competitively and fairly. That's a little easier to do in large towns and cities than it is to do in small towns. And so I would think that their biggest challenge is to figure out how do we serve those small towns in a way that's honest, that's credible, and that builds back the trust.
Do you think big companies like in the United States are kind of watching this as well?
I think they are, because they certainly had these experiences with major kind of consumer movements in different categories. I think in the U.S. there's a bit more cynicism and acceptance that the big corporations kind of work against us, both that thing and the notion of the American way, that like capitalism is the way to go. So if you can get people to pay more for something, good for you. So I think there's they're definitely watching, but I think also the American consumer has a different mentality at almost all income levels about whether, you know, corporations are really abusing them, when what we call abuse to them is maybe just good capitalism, as long as there's a competitive alternative.
Right. And what I wonder about this too is, well, what is the end result that people are hoping for? Do they want to see lower prices? And if you're Loblaws, like how do you do that? How are you going to please people to end a boycott?
I think that the proof is going to be in the pudding. It's, you know, perception is often more important than reality. And I think the way most consumers perceive pricing in grocery stores is those staples that they buy regularly. And how do those staples feel? Because those are the things they feel like they spend, and they do spend a lot of money on over the course of a year. So it's the milk, it's the eggs, it's the bread. Do I feel like there's some reliability here and some consistency and competitive fairness in those staples? I think that's how they do it.
All right. Must be fascinating times in the business world. Grant, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Grant Packard, Program Director at the Schulich School of Business at York University, talking about the case study that is becoming Loblaws. There's this boycott, I'm sure you've heard of it, it's been all over the news, all over social media, really, that this is the month where people are going to be boycotting Loblaws and all its different iterations and companies that they have. But is the company actually doing anything, or are they even worried about this? It is a fascinating case study to see how big companies deal with this kind of chatter or movement on social media. Do they even worry about it? If you want to weigh in, are you participating in this boycott? Let me know. Simi@cknw.com. Do you even think boycotts work? I think that is the bigger question here too, right? You'd like to think that you have that buying power, that if you say, I'm not going to buy this, that means something. But does it?
This is Mornings with Simi.
I would say we are at crunch time here, right? Canucks face Game 6 tomorrow in Nashville. It's certainly on the minds of Canucks fans out there. Barry DeLay is with us now, sports anchor and reporter at Global. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Simi.
Would you call this crunch time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, playoffs is always crunch time, but it's, you know, it's like as we've said before, it's the ups and downs of the playoffs. I mean, you know, everyone, I think a lot of people were hoping that the Canucks would seal the deal. But I tell you what, in playoffs, there are no givens. There's something about road teams, too. Here's a good stat. Going into last night in the Western, just in the Western Conference, the road team had a 13-5 record. The road team, 13-5. Both home teams won last night, so it's 13-7. But this home ice advantage thing, it's not just this year. It's been like that forever. I don't know what it is in the Stanley Cup playoffs. It's hard. It seems harder to win at home. It seems the road teams, maybe a little more relaxed, a little less pressure to you know, kind of put on a show for the home team, and they just kind of get down to business. So that's positive. And the Canucks have never lost a playoff game in Nashville ever. They're 5-0. They were 3-0 in 2011.
I love how we go for the stats, right? Don't we just really, we're going to hold on to those no matter what we do.
especially when there's 2 days between games. You got to do something to fill the time. You know?
Right. I'm thinking, too, of what Rick Tocchet said last week about when they originally went to Nashville for those first two games, and that he tells them to embrace it, right? That it's great to play the villain. And maybe that's easier for them to do, too. Maybe they can embrace that better.
Yeah, it certainly. I mean, it's been a physical series. So, I mean, Nashville's got it's a wild atmosphere there as well. But, I mean, in the first game, the Canucks won 2-0 or 2-1, I guess, when Nashville scored late. I mean, the Canucks took the crowd right out of the game because Nashville didn't score till really late. And, yeah, that's what you can do. I mean, on the road, you can take that crowd out and a big hit. I mean, Zadorov's been a villain. He's been crushing guys left and right, knocking them on their butts. So it's that's the way to go. I mean, it seems like there should be less pressure. Maybe that's a place where Pettersson, maybe we've been waiting for him to do something.
I
feel
know.
For the guy, but it's, you know, that's life when you're one of the big stars. If you don't produce, you got to kind of put up with it. But he's, I know he's trying and he's doing his best, but it's at the end of the day, it's results oriented. It's hard. It's very difficult to win a series when one of your top players doesn't score.
Like, I know. So, Barry, you know, yeah. I'm like with you, right? Like, you can't help. You don't want to do it because you feel bad because it looks, you can tell he's trying.
Yeah.
But when you sign a huge contract like that right before the playoffs, yeah, it's good. People are going to talk about it.
It's like you, Simi, when you signed the big deal at CKNW, people expect results, right?
Is that in an alternate universe where that happened?
I was trying to think, who makes better than money in radio? It's Simi, okay.
No, yeah,
that's the
no.
thing, though, right? It's that, yeah, that when the money's there, that's part of the deal. Like, if you're going to take the big bucks, you got to put up with everything he has here. But the thing I've said before with Pettersson, if something can go right for him, I know it can turn on a dime. His confidence seems to waver, good or bad. It can go either way really quickly. So, but they need something good to happen. He needs one to bounce off his knee into the net or something, and I think it'll turn for him. But they need him. They know that. But hey, the positive is, if you look at it this way, they're up 3-2, and he really has not contributed a whole lot. The one or two assists on the power play, he's been all right. But if they can get just a little something from him, wow, would that change things.
Yes, and then Edmonton is waiting. Barry, thank you so much for that.
You got it. Thanks, Simi.
All right, we'll talk to you tomorrow. That's Barry DeLay, sports anchor reporter at Global. Yes, of course, now we know the Edmonton Oilers are waiting because they took out the LA Kings last night, but the Canucks play Nashville tomorrow. Today, the big game is the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Boston Bruins. Another tense one, I know, for a lot of Canadian hockey fans out there. So yeah, so much to talk about when it comes to sports. And of course, we'll continue to follow all of that.
This is Mornings with Simi.
For 8 years now, BC has been in a public health emergency, dealing with a toxic drug and overdose crisis. Now, that emergency has pushed the provincial government to try all sorts of things, including, yes, a very controversial experiment with drug decriminalization and safe supply. But with this, we are now dealing with a public safety problem as well, right? People seem to have lost faith in the system working for them and keeping them safe. It's as though we don't trust our institutions anymore to uphold those kind of pillars of society. Now, was it always like this, or what has changed? Well, retired Justice Thomas Gove has been a lawyer and a provincial court judge for decades before retiring just a couple of years ago. You may remember the work that he did with the Gove Inquiry into Child Protection. I mean, that work led to an overhaul of the child protection system here in BC. He also helped create the Downtown Community Court. That's a unique way of kind of moving offenders through the system. So you could say he's been there, he has done that, he has seen it all, and he has thoughts about what he sees happening right now. And to learn more about those thoughts, he joins us now, retired Justice the Honorable Thomas Gove. Thank you so much for being here.
Morning.
Now, you decided to write about this publicly. I see you have a piece in the Vancouver Sun today talking about this. Why did you want to speak about what you see going on out there?
Well, I, like most people in British Columbia, have been observing how the situation with regards to drug addiction, and in particular addiction in the community, is getting worse. And I believe that it was a time for people like myself to speak out. It seems so clear that we need to get the public to focus on treatment and help these individuals who have found themselves in this terrible situation of drug addiction.
What do you think has changed, Justice Gove, given from the time that you were on the court and you were, you know, you saw the work on the downtown east side? What changed to have us end up like this?
Well, at one time, I mean, 60 years ago, British Columbia was recognized as a pioneer in rehabilitating people who were addicted to drugs, and many of whom came to the criminal justice system. Unfortunately, this is no longer the case. We used to have forestry camps, used to have treatment programs, used to have outward bounds camps. We used to work with the people, and particularly young people, to get them out of the drug lifestyle and back into a healthy lifestyle. What we see now is we can look out our windows and see the chaos. You see, in British Columbia, I believe that clinicians know how to deal with and work with people who are addicted to drugs. We have a lot of expertise in this province. We need to let these people, doctors, social workers, nurses, counselors, get on with providing what's needed both in the community and in particular residential treatment.
Okay, how do you envision that working? What do you think needs to be put into place?
Well, firstly, I think we need to treat people who are drug addicted and require a removal from their environment into a hospital-type setting as a priority. Other provinces do this. We don't do that in British Columbia. You talk to any parent who has a child who is addicted to drugs, and they'll tell you the struggle to find where to get help, the struggle to keep the child alive while they're on a waiting list to get into some program in some future date and place. Unless a person in this province has the financial means to pay for private treatment, private residential treatment, they are on a road that is extremely, extremely difficult. We need to change our attitude. We need to change our approach. These are people that require a health approach. And we haven't been doing it for some years.
You asked this question in the piece that you wrote here. You said, why are we not treating them as patients of the healthcare system? And I've wondered that myself. Like, why doesn't that happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why. I don't, it seems to me so blatantly obvious that people who are addicted to a drug that they can't seem to stop on their own need to be treated as patients. There's a great reluctance, it appears, to put people into residential care. I appreciate that on one hand, residential care, of course, is expensive. On the other hand, you're taking away some of their rights to make choices, their liberties. But let's be realistic. The cost to society today of not doing that is, we're told by the Ministry of Mental Health and Addiction's own website, billions of dollars. Billions of dollars in terms of human lives, but also in terms of crime in our community and so on. I mean, this is not news to someone like yourself. It's been in the news now for some years.
But do you think, is this a problem?
We all know the problems there.
Is this a problem of not enough treatment then, do you think? Is it that people want that option and they can't find that option? Or is it that we're not providing enough different kinds of options, perhaps like we did in the past?
Well, I think both. But I think in particular, we're not providing the number of options. We're not providing the beds, basically. We're not providing the treatment places and beds and so forth to treat these folk. You know, we've got a population in this province which is in the millions. We have the number of government funded beds for treatment is in the hundreds. You know, we also heard, and we haven't heard recently, but I'm sure you talked about it in the past, the many, many treatment, what they call treatment homes or recovery homes, that are run by often by charitable organizations, sometimes by individuals, to supposedly help people get off of drug addiction. And those of us who worked in the court system for years know that most of those are not effective. They're not helpful. They're not really treatment. They're helpful, but they're not treatment. We need actual treatment. And we've got people in this province who know how to do that.
When you were in the criminal court, at the downtown community court, and you had people coming before you, what did you notice that's different back then versus today? Is it the way we are treating people? Is it like, are people different today than they were when they came to court?
Oh, I think there's a lot. There's much more today. People who are drug addicted who come to court are in a much more desperate situation. I think the drugs are different. We certainly still have heroin, but the addition of fentanyl and other drugs, methamphetamine, people are more desperate to get help or to get more drugs. The other problem is we had more resources 20 years ago than we have now. We had places, some were good, some were not as good, but we had places that we could send people to. They would receive treatment. We had a whole string of camps. There was about 9 or 10 forestry camps in the Chilliwack Valley and up in the Maple Ridge area, where young, usually men, learnt how to get up in the morning, have their breakfast, get dressed, get the chainsaw, and get out working in the woods under the supervision of corrections officers, with an idea that they not only would get healthy, but upon their release from their period of incarceration, they would have some skills and they could start getting themselves into a workforce in which they could take some pride. We've closed all that down. Prisons now are viewed by many of us who worked in the system as simply warehouses. And, the people that work there are doing the best they can, but they're not viewed anymore as treatment programs.
Listen, thank you so much for your time this morning and explaining your thoughts to us. We appreciate that.
Okay, Timmy, thank you.
That's retired Justice the Honorable Thomas Scove, of course, longtime judge, retired a couple of years ago, did lots of work, especially on child protection here in this province, talking about what he sees has gone wrong in how we are treating offenders in the system and the public safety issue. Now, you can read more about his thoughts. He presents them in the Vancouver Sun today. You can read that. You can weigh in as well, simi@cknw.com.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.